Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. Okay, we are in paper 75, section 2, which is old single column, page 840. Okay, for an intro, I want to do a little backtracking. You know, obviously, section 2, we just got into this paper on the default of Adam and Eve. And I'd like to just step us through that final paragraph of section 1 again. Because notice it has an italicized word in it. It's obviously being highlighted. It'll get us back in the frame of reference before we jump right into the details that they're about to unpack of how everything went sideways here. So let me just step right in. It says, probably no material sons of Nebadon were ever faced with such a difficult and seemingly hopeless task as confronted Adam and Eve in the sorry plight of Urantia. Just highlight there. Notice the seemingly hopeless. I think we stressed this before. That very issue that I so often bring up that's so important to begin developing your objective consciousness is to reflect on that distinction between appearance and reality. That difference is not as it initially appears, if you will, or seems. In its full, precise sense, those are both objective. It isn't the difference between subjective and objective when you talk about appearance and reality, respectively. It's you've gotten the basic issues of subjectivity out of the way, and you have that objective appearance of things that you're engaging. But we have to all keep reminding ourselves, as Adam and Eve forgot to keep reminding themselves, that you can't see reality. Appearance is not reality. You have to use your insight to penetrate through the appearance and begin to develop a recognition of the reality behind the appearance. See, so you can just, as soon as you see the revelator say something like that, and seemingly hopeless task, you put in parenthetically in your mind, but not really. Right? And that's the crux of the whole problem, is they forgot that parenthetical. Right, but not really. No matter how hopeless it seems, it's not really hopeless. Right? And Jesus' affirmation, despite all appearances, right, to the contrary, he knows it really. Right, that's the key. And then they continue on here. But they would have sometime met with success had they been more far-seeing and patient. And of course, see, there's just reminding you, yeah, it wasn't really hopeless. They would have sometime met with success. And we have far-seeing and patient in that order. Patient being the foundational word. And it's italicized to just stress that fact. Every phase of your cosmic consciousness, every facet of your cosmic character, your potential cosmic character, your potential cosmic consciousness, is predicated on patience. That is the foundational fact. Until there's patience, there is no cosmic consciousness. There is no cosmic character. There is no relationship to truth. There is no spiritualized mind. There is no personal mind. There is no personal self. Without personality, there can't be far-seeing. The only way that you have any concept of the future is because you're not just a fancy animal, you're a personality. That opens up a recognition of future in contrast to merely present and past that you have as an animal. Okay, so the far-seeing is built upon that foundation of patience. And when you're dealing with default and rebellion, patience is where it all starts to go sideways. You know, the lack of patience. And we, as I point out all the time, you can see that everything I just said is directly represented, so it's easy to visualize in the hourglass analogy of your mind or self. That neck, and then in the middle of the neck is the third level of meaning, the level of patience. Obviously, everything in the upper domain, all relationship to the cosmos, everything that's about you that can be objective, is on that foundation of the level of patience. You can't get to anything up there except through patience. It's just literally visualized in that analogy. And so when it's default, merely default, it basically, you arrest the tangential phenomenon there at the beginning. It's just self-righteous impatience. But when you go further to rebellion, you don't stop with self-righteous impatience. You go into a conscious turning around of things, deliberate action. It goes to self-righteous deceit when it goes to rebellion. But you can't get to that personal fact that we're talking about there in self-righteous deceit unless you first have failed to be requisitely patient. So it's all predicated on that. They want us so they're stressing that up front. That's the whole key. That's where, if you do nothing else with the revelation, with the fifth epical revelation, there's only one thing that you can seem to find the ability to focus on. It should be that. To recognize that your budding spiritual consciousness is inherently impatient. It needs a bridle. And you need to take a hold of the reins. How many times do I, jokingly, say, what do we want, fill in the blank, when do we want it now? Right? I mean, that's just, it's right there, that everyone that does that is a poster child for what we're reading about right here. There's no patience there. Adam and Eve were effectively drafting one of those signs and believing it. So it's very, very relevant. Okay. So it continues on. Both of them, especially Eve, were altogether too impatient. They were not willing to settle down to the long, long endurance test. And again, see, that's all of us have to do that. Once you have some awareness of the potential better state in the future, you have to settle down to the long, long endurance test relative to that future. Just super fundamental and important. Okay, and so, well, what if you do start believing your protest sign? What happens? They wanted to see some immediate results, and they did. But the results thus secured proved most disastrous, both to themselves and to their world. And the stress there again, when the revelators use that word disastrous, that literally means apart from the stars, right, you can recognize, oh, apart from the cosmos. Right? That's fundamentally the problem. When you're not patient, you will get yourself apart from the cosmos. The evolutionary process of the cosmos requires patience to synchronize with it. It's been going for trillions and trillions of years already, and it's going to go for a lot of trillions of years still. Your lifetime is a very poor measure of the time constant of the evolutionary process. Each of those sentences has a little foundational nugget. Okay, so what, you know, now they're going to get into the specifics. How exactly did Adam and Eve find themselves in this state where they lost sight of that big picture and the patience that it requires? How did that sneak up on them? I mean, it must have, you know, it must have snuck on them unaware, snuck up on them unawares. I mean, you know, we know that they were well trained and that with vast experience. You know, they're not fools. It must have been a sneaky thing, just the same kind of sneaky thing that we might, you know, find ourselves caught up in unwittingly. So let's see what we've got here for details.
Section 2, Caligastia's plot. Caligastia paid frequent visits to the garden and held many conferences with Adam and Eve, but they were adamant to all his suggestions of compromise and shortcut adventures. They had before them enough of the results of rebellion to produce effective immunity against all such insinuating proposals. Even the young offspring of Adam were uninfluenced by the overtures of Caligastia. And of course, neither Caligastia nor his associate had power to influence any individual against his will, much less to persuade the children of Adam to do wrong.
Okay. Just a fun little tidbit, you know, if you haven't ever thought about the literalness the historical roots of the word adamant. You know, that's the mythical substance that's unbreakable. And so we use it in metaphorical terms, you know, here, not as a noun, but to mean unyielding. See, they were unyielding to all his suggestions. So, you know, that just speaks to what I was just pointing out. I mean, you know, they're very clear-eyed about this. Any sort of a direct attempt, you know, to get them to go off track is not going to work. They're rock solid in that regard.
Why'd they let him in there all the time? He says they made frequent visits. I mean, they couldn't keep him out.
You can't keep him out. You can walk through any wall. No carnivore is going to eat him. So like we pointed out, I mean, that's a very strange thing to even imagine with all the rebels. You know, it's not just Caligastia and Caligastia. It's all the other rebels that are, too, you know. They're just, you know, like little annoying dogs, you know, yapping at their heels all the time. Just, you know. Yeah, you know, you think that they would just like go away. I can't think, you know. But you know, the fact that you can, you know, the way they say it, they held many conferences. I mean, see, Adam and Eve still are, you know, giving them respect, because as they're about to point out in the next paragraph, right, he's still planetary prince, even though he's gone way off the rails. So, he's like, you know, he wants a conference. Okay, well, set up a conference. Right? I mean, they're giving him that sort of procedural respect like that. Okay, and one other, you know, interesting thing between the lines there, You know, Caligastia is engaging Adam and Eve directly, but you know, usually the lieutenant, you know, like when we talk about Lucifer and Satan, you know, Satan, the lieutenant, is almost always the point person on engaging others. It's almost always the same way with Caligastia and Dalagastia, as we talked about back when we talked about the planetary prince. But Caligastia is taking point on Adam and Eve. But, you know, the kids, no, Dalagastia's, you know, going after the kids. And it does see point out that, you know, that first generation is, you know, is only partially downstepped to really match in to the evolutionary peoples. I mean, that first generation has, you know, they can engage some of the invisible, quote-unquote, you know, beings and stuff. I mean, Caligastia can come up and talk to them. So, you know, that's a little clue about, you know, just how much different is that first generation from subsequent generations. We don't, you know, you might suspect that maybe they can't see as extensively, you know, non-corporeal beings as Adam and Eve. But, you know, here we have Dalagastia engaging them. So, you know, that's a fairly high being, relatively speaking. So apparently, you know, the first generation do have quite a bit of ability. You know, and we saw that the Adam and Eve could engage them, you know, through that mind communication mechanism also. So, they're sort of quasi-material sons and daughters still, that first generation. You know, good on the kids. I mean, the kids have been well-educated by Adam and Eve. None of them, you know, were susceptible. You know, even pointing out much less to persuade the children of Adam to do wrong.
Well, it wasn't just the direct kids, because after this must have been 100 years. It lasts for 100-some-odd years, so there could have been a few generations.
Right, but see, the thing is, you know, the second generation and on, they can't engage them, yeah. So, all right. Let's see, I think we got everything there. Okay, so now, like I said, what's this next little tidbit they give us here?
It must be remembered that Caligastia was still the titular planetary prince of Urantia, a misguided but nevertheless high son of the local universe. He was not finally disposed until the times of Christ Michael on Urantia.
So, do you remember a little more precisely when he was finally deposed? What point when Michael is here in his seventh bestowal?
When he sees Lucifer falling from the... Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's this, no, but you know, something a little less biblical, yeah, you know, right? What in the story we get in the book, is it before the baptism, after the baptism?
It's a,
you remember?
It was on Mount Hermon.
Yeah, on Mount Hermon, exactly. Remember when he's on Mount Hermon, you know, as Jesus, just the Son of Man, not the Son of God, just Jesus the man, master physical controllers visualize Satan and Caligastia. See, there you have Satan, see, representing Lucifer in that. Satan and Caligastia are visualized to Jesus, and he engages them. And when he brushes aside all their efforts to get him to join the cause, right, immediately subsequent to that is when, on the universe records, he is declared planetary prince. And that's the point at which he officially deposes Caligastia, as they're saying here, who still holds the title at this point, you know, all these thousands of years ago. All right, so, it isn't, you know, say at Pentecost or anything like that. It's, you know, it's before the whole public ministry. So, you know, when he's, you know, in his public ministry, he's technically, see, the planetary prince of Urantia. You know, he holds that title. So that's another thing, see, why he has the option of doing what he did, you know, to hang around post when he would have fused if he was just a mortal, you know, post-baptism, right? Because he's... the planetary prince is, you know, normally around all the time before the bestowal son arrives and all the time after the bestowal son. So that adds to why he could, you know, do what he did. Obviously the reason they mention that here is just, you go, well, why on earth would they have conferences with him? Why wouldn't they just tell him to get lost? All right? See, because, you know, he still has the right to demand a conference, and he's still planetary prince. Okay.
But the fallen prince was persistent and determined. He soon gave up working on Adam and decided to try a wily flank attack on Eve. The evil one concluded that the only hope for success lay in the adroit employment of suitable persons belonging to the upper strata of the Nodite group, the descendants of his one-time corporeal staff associates, and the plans were accordingly laid for entrapping the mother of the Violet race.
Okay. Remember, it's just Nodite, because it's Nod. You know, they're the Nodites, named after Nod. An adroit employment. Again, don't underestimate just how clever a Lenonendek could be, right? I mean, they are so much more intelligent than, you know, we are. So they can scheme big schemes, you know. We're talking, you know, the usual analogy of three-dimensional chess, right? I mean, they can play an elaborate game of chess. And, many, many, many moves in advance, they're thinking this out. You know, little subtle things that no one's going to pick up on. And before anyone knows what's happening, right, he gets his way. Now, back up there when they italicized patient, I could have mentioned that they were about to get into that a little bit more, and they hinted at it. It's like, wait a minute, what's this bit about, and the plans were accordingly laid for entrapping the mother of the Violet race? Why not the father of the Violet race? What is the issue where potentially there's a more straightforward avenue to find an Achilles heel relative to patience with Eve than with Adam? We'll get that, you know, next here in the next paragraph. Let's see, anything else there? He was persistent and determined. I mean, again, you know, think about how much more straightforward it would be for you to take the long-term view if you weren't mortal. You know, how long has Caligastia been hanging around this planet at this point? Yeah, more than 450,000 years. There's none of that. I mean, see, he has an innate patience, right, that he's playing off of. Even though all of the rebels on high that he joined in with were impatient on a lot longer time scale, you know, on the scale of hundreds of thousands, you know, or millions of years, they were impatient. But relative to, you know, the doings on this world, okay, I mean, he can't help but approach us patiently because he's not mortal. There's none of that 100-year consciousness going on in his head. So, he innately has a leg up on Adam and Eve, see, in that regard, just by the nature of his being. He hasn't been downstepped in any way like Adam and Eve got downstepped, you know, and they went from Gerasim to here, you know, which brought them even more into a temporal, you know, relationship to things, right, than they were back on Gerasim. He's still in the, you know, I've been around for hundreds of millions of years, you know, sort of mentality. All right.
Part of the intelligence you were getting at, you know, he knows he can go the long game, and these guys are novice, and he's feeling pretty confident.
Yeah, and he knows that even though Adam and Eve are technically immortal, you know, at this point as well, he knows that they have to work with all of these mortals who are all, you know, champing at the bit, you know, to, you know, have something happen. And right, so he knows he's got the advantage here.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was farthest from Eve's intention ever to do anything which would
militate
against Adam's plans or jeopardize their planetary trust. Knowing the tendency of women to look upon immediate results rather than to plan farsightedly for more remote effects, the Melchizedeks, before departing, had especially enjoined Eve as to the peculiar dangers besetting their isolated position on the planet, and had in particular warned her never to stray from the side of her mate. That is, to attempt no personal or secret methods of furthering their mutual undertakings. Eve had most scrupulously carried out these instructions for more than 100 years, and it did not occur to her that any danger would attach to the increasingly private and confidential visits she was enjoying with a certain Nodite leader named Serapetatia. The whole affair developed so gradually and naturally that she was taken unawares.
Let me just note the thing at the very end before we get into the meat there. So gradually and naturally. I see that's the key. Right, what was I stressing up front? In order to prevent something like this happening to you, you can't be functioning merely naturally. Right? What prevents this is inherently unnatural. Right? It's your personal over-control of yourself, not the natural doings of yourself. It prevents this. There's nothing within the naturalness of any self that even mitigates, let alone would militate against this phenomenon. So that's why they put in that naturally. She was letting herself. Now, remember we talked about how the material gravity was dragging him down, right? So everything is getting more and more just natural, and here we see a specific example of how this is a big problem. Everyone else involved has to maintain that unnatural objectivity, keeping their head above water, keeping their eye on the big picture, so that they don't unwittingly through some gradual process, you know, where every day, you know, it's a fraction of a degree, you know, off course, you know, you never notice. But as the months and years roll by, you've gone way off course. And the only way that you can keep tabs on that is if you are constantly looking at yourself from the top down, you'll notice those slight deviations. But down in the trenches, it appears you're going on a dead straight line. Now, you can't see that slow curve.
Yeah. This is being related by Salonia.
Yep.
Who was there?
Yep, who was there?
There's nothing intimating that Salonia certainly could see what was transpiring.
Yeah, well, I mean, she'll get to that. She'll get to how she attempted to help. But again, remember, how did they describe Adam and Eve? They are the rulers. I mean, everyone knows, read a story about, human doings with some king or queen of old. Did you just walk up to the king and explain to them how they were really off track here? No, you get your head chopped off. Right? I mean, Adam and Eve are not going to chop Salonia's head off. Okay, but I mean, but that dynamic is in play. I mean, they are the rulers. They are in charge. And free will choice is respected in the universe. Yeah. So, all right. So, right. It's just so sneaky because it's gradual, and it's that pleasant comfortableness. You know, nothing tweaks you when you just let yourself slip into what comes naturally, right? Okay. So now this whole issue, right, that they bring to a definite point there. Knowing the tendency of women to look upon immediate results rather than to plan farsightedly for more remote effects. So there's the farsightedly again, the far-seeing, like we saw up at the top again.
You're saying women or woman?
Tendency of woman. Did I say women? I don't. Okay.
Singular or plural.
It is singular. Yeah.
I know. My wife is not one of those women.
Now, okay. There's two things that have to be kept in mind so that we don't get off on some problematic PC, non-PC tangent with this. Okay. First of all, just the basic fact that men and women, respectively, are expressions of direction and place. Okay. When you think about that far-seeing, right, you have a tendency to move your hand along a line like that towards some future thing that you're visualizing. See, there's direction there. It's more immediate for that side of the dual expression, for the direction side of the dual expression, to keep that goal point in mind, because it's just inherently you're thinking in terms of a line instead of in terms of a circle. You know, direction instead of place. And also we have to remember, this is a material son and daughter. This is not, a male and female evolutionary human. Right? If you take the bell curves of males and females on this planet, right, the centers of those bell curve distributions of the nature of men and women, right, you will notice the direction place differential between men and women. Okay, but there's, it's a broad spectrum of, for us evolutionary expressions of that twofold pattern. There's a lot of biologic females that are quite directional, a lot of biologic males that are quite place-like, not to mention intensely place-like, with some biologic females, and intensely direction-like for some biologic males. But when you're talking about a material son and daughter, you don't have, normal distributions. You don't have bell curve distributions, right? There are these very delta function, these spike-like expressions. One is pure direction and one is pure place. Right? And we talked about that. They are very dependent upon each other to have the whole picture. They have to stay, as they pointed out here, in close contact with one another, so that, there's two eyes. They kind of just have one eye, as it were, see? Each of them. You take that phenomenon that you can observe amongst humans, statistically, you'll see this differential between direction and place with evolutionary mortals. But with them, it's just right. Every pair is a precise expression of this. And so, Eve, even though she was, specifically reminded of this over and over and over and over again, it all happened so gradually, and they've been so drugged down, so they're losing the big picture. She didn't notice that. It's like, wait a minute, I'm spending long spans of time without the other half, my other eyeball, so that I have three-dimensional vision here. And the next thing she knows, she's lost sight. And goes off track. Now the other thing that feeds into it, the fact that she's engaging a mortal male, Serapeitatia. See, unconsciously, there would be this tendency to think that there are two eyeballs in play. But she forgot to remind herself, that's it's not the quality of their eyeball that you need in Serapeitatia. Serapeitatia is not Adam. But see, just naturally, that would have fed into this. It's like I'm still have the duality in play, so everything is going to be okay. She needed to catch herself with that natural thought and overrule it unnaturally, and she wasn't doing that. Reminding herself of the quality differential. Not all males are, interchangeable parts here in this regard. Okay.
By Adam's side was not burned into her head.
Right. And again, it's just it all. If everything was on a normal world running smoothly, you could keep they can keep these thoughts in their head, But it's just there's so many things, I mean, they're both running around like, chickens with their head cut off all day long. I'm sure both of them, there's constantly fires they've got to put out. It's just, organized chaos that they're trying to manage, on this planet. And so it just, you can just, in the midst of all that confusion, you lose sight of even something that was so, quote unquote, burned into you, burned into her brain. All right, so that's, it's that place direction thing. When you think about it, it's an interesting, when you think about the genetic tendencies with human males and females, on the one hand, in terms of material affairs, statistically, a female will have this tendency of, wanting an immediate result and not being patient for something long term. But in another way, think about how inherently patient a circle is relative to an arrow, right? If you use that analogy, for place and direction. The hand that rocks the cradle still fraternizes with destiny. See, in some bigger things, right, there's a more immediate patience in a female than a male, right? And we all know that cliche story, with the guy. It's like, well, it seemed like a good idea at the time, right? He says, it's like ridiculously impatient and, impetuous and, impulsive and does something and then regrets it. It's not a simplistic difference, right? In some ways, one is more patient than the other, but in other ways, it's the reverse. Men and women need each other, right? They're complementary, and especially when you think, through lots and lots of different settings. In one particular setting, a particular human male or female might navigate it just fine. But statistically, right, over the long term, lots of different things, it's very helpful to have that contrast between the human male and the human female to try to increase the chances of approaching things objectively.
Extreme ends of the bell curve would be more like Adam and Eve, and people now would be in between somewhere.
Exactly. They're the far tails, of our bell curves. So it's so, you know, important to not get all wrapped around the axle with, you know, the apparent political incorrectness of what's said here. This isn't some male-dominated author. No, this is Solonia. Solonia is a she, okay? A she is writing this paper, not a he. She because she knows of what she speaks. Right? It's not just because she was there. Right? A she understands this. And we all have to be humble about our limitations and make sure that one way or another we interact with others to make up for our incompleteness, you know, whatever incompleteness it might be.
Adam probably didn't have a jealous bone in his body, but it seems like he might have been well served to be a jealous.
Well, again, you know, see, it's very difficult. Yeah, I mean that's that issue of jealousy or something like that on the part of Adam. I mean, yeah, again, it's, you know, we're often reminded as we read about Adam and Eve, you know, it's hard for us to put ourselves in their place. I mean, they are so matter of fact about the whole procreation issue, right? We're fraught with all kinds of moray, you know, notions and taboos and what have you, you know, in this regard. You know, and remember, jealousy is not biologic, no matter how much it appears that it's biologic. You know, that's taught. That's nurture, not nature. It's one of the startling things in the Revelation when they point that out, that jealousy is a nurture phenomenon and not a nature phenomenon. It seems so innate. So
not even have
automatic.
They may not even have jealousy.
Yeah, yeah, and right. And that's kind of what I was getting at. You see, you know, they. Right, I mean, they approach this in such an objective way that you know they just are never going to be thinking in those terms of, you know, aren't you spending too much time with my wife? You know, that those sorts of thoughts aren't even remotely in their head. You know.
God, let's go see him together.
Okay. Let's see here. You know, and notice the use of danger. All right. See, there's a potential for some unwitting dominance thing here to slip in. You're going to be dominated by something you're not aware of and that you don't want to be dominated by. Every time they use that word danger. Let's see, I think we got everything there, didn't we? You know, it's just, I have to comment, increasingly private and confidential. It's like, Eve, wouldn't there be an alarm bell going off? It's like, wait a minute, I'm having increasingly private and confidential. Yeah, but again, it was so gradual, right? And there's so much going on, right? It was lost in the noise. She didn't notice it. Again, like I was saying, because it's just, they're so matter-of-fact about these sorts of things, right? You know, she's never going to be thinking, I'm going to cheat on my husband or something. You know, I mean, those thoughts are just aren't even remotely there, right, to trigger an alarm bell. She's not having to overrule some moray notion like that. See?
So,
yeah.
So it wasn't hot as far as she's concerned.
Well, actually, Serapeutica would have been really physically hot, yes. But as they're about to point out, but that's again, that's just, you know, that's not, you know, an issue there. Until you really let yourself slip all the way down to the biologic, as they point out, you know, when the final deed is done here. Okay, when you slip all the way down, and it's just a pure biologic hormonal phenomenon, those things definitely have a role now. Did we get everything? There's a big, great big paragraph. Yeah, no personal or secret. Well, how about private and confidential? No, that's it's just, you know, it's so funny. All right, go ahead.
The garden dwellers had been in contact with the Nodites.
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 Yeah.
since the early days of Eden. From these mixed descendants of the defaulting members of Caligastia's staff, they had received much valuable help and cooperation, and through them, the Edenic regime was now to meet its complete undoing and final overthrow.
So again, why do they throw in that? Just another, you know, we've been thinking of all these reasons why this slipped under her radar. You know, there's yet another one. Right? I mean, there is this very wonderful, you know, helpful relationship that's developed. Received much valuable help and cooperation. Right? So, right, I mean, this isn't something, you know, out in left field. I mean, you know, they're trying to think of all the ways that they can leverage off of this fortunate fact that you have Nodites on this planet. You know, you normally don't have Nodites. You don't have this biologically upstepped additional race that they can leverage off of. You know, and so they're really, you know, their gears are churning on that. It's like, wow, this is really handy. See, and that's a little seed, right, that they take, that Eve ends up taking too far. Yeah, you can leverage off of them culturally, you know, even at the beginning, but don't leverage off them biologically at the beginning. And that's the line she crosses.
Were these Nodites kind of direct and conscious about their,
yeah, their heritage, you mean? Well, or
in particular, you know, contributing to the garden, or in the guise of contributing to the garden, are they kind of in the loop on Caligastia's ends here? Or are they just unwitting pawns in it? The Nodites.
They never explain after all this time, you know, 150,000 years, what kind of concept the Nodites have about non-corporeal beings on the planet. How much have they held on to some objective understanding of the primary midwayers, say, and these sorts of things, or how much has that all kind of gotten lost in the fog of, remember, all the peoples have all kinds of beliefs about spirits and whatnot. They may have lost all, basically objective understanding of the doings in the unseen, sectors of the planet. We don't get any clues about how much, say Van and Amadon over all that time might have been reminding people of this, how much Adam and Eve might have reminded. I mean, one thought that you can definitely have there is both Van and Amadon and Adam and Eve wouldn't be seriously disrupting the normal evolution of primitive religious notions of ghost land and spirit land and all that sort of stuff. So, I don't know. It's hard to say how much they might have been trying to keep people from, even the Nodites from going off on fancy tangents, stories and beliefs about such things. So I don't know.
Well, I'm just wondering if the Nodites were a party to the deception, or were they just useful idiots?
You'll see that then they get into it a little bit. I mean, the Nodites are, remember they even pointed that out up front here, at least in general, that the Caligastia is going to, employ suitable persons belonging to the upper strata of the Nodite group. Okay, I mean, but he's very clever here, as they pointed out. It's probably nothing overt, because he doesn't want, any of them to just happen to mention, it's like, I was I actually engaged a primary midwayer yesterday, and they had this thought. I mean, so it's probably sneaky little tweaking, you know, that they don't pick up on. And he just, you know, slowly manipulates the situation, you know, where eventually they're having this conversation that plants seeds in Sarah Patasia's mind, you know, about a groovy idea that, to you know, accelerate the process. My guess is that, you know, he was very careful, him and all of, he and all of his other rebels, to have it not be any sort of a direct thing that, you know, would have led to some suspicion in any way. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
They were certainly all well intentioned.
Yeah.
And they were. Yeah. They had their good intentions. Yeah. Used.
Yeah. I mean, we know for certain that the core group, you know, had no idea that they were being used. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't rule out some, you know, you know, individual, you know, that might actually be consciously involved in, you know, machinations with rebel secondary or primary midwayers or something, you know. And, you know, there may be some conscious doings often, but, you know, definitely Sarah Patasia and immediate people around him, none of them are, in, you know, there's no deceit, you know, there's nothing insincere at all. They may stress that as we go forward, you know, amongst that core group. You know, that's engaging Eve. Okay. All right, let's see, where were we? Oh, yeah, we did the final paragraph. That's right. Okay, so you know, the irony that they're throwing in there at the end, and we often talk about this, that if you don't have your thoughts in a proper frame of wisdom, proper frame of reference, you get the exact opposite. All right? Lucifer had his thought, didn't have his thoughts in a proper frame of reference. So, you know, he was vectoring towards light and life, and he got the exact opposite, the orgy of darkness and death. And as they're pointing out here, you know, the complete undoing and final overthrow. Instead of a wonderful positive thing, you get the exact opposite. That's just the way it always works. You know, and they stress that all the time to try to sober you about this. It's like, well, you know, okay, so maybe I don't have lots of wisdom, you know, but how far off, you know, could I get, you know, in my efforts to help things? It doesn't work that way. You won't just, you know, have it off by 2 degrees. You know, when you do things in an unwise fashion, it flips 180 degrees. Change without growth is potential evil. Not, you know, it's not that it's, well, it's not as good as it could have been. You know, it goes from good to evil.
Very binary.
Right? It's very binary.
Well, look how long it took the apostles to go right away, off in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
And not necessarily, you know, with all the good intentions, and, you know, the angels end up working with them, but we get to where we are. But as you said many times, it all turns out in the end. But
yeah, and see, it's simply because of this dominance thing. You know, the way they use the word danger. You know, just remember how this happens. You know, you're using your personality up on top, engaging a binary fact. Good, bad. And, you know, that if you engage it good, okay, you impose that direction down on your mind. But if, you know, you have things flipped around, right, then you impose the exact opposite. I mean, there's only 2 directions so that you can impose from on top. You know, that spirit direction on your mind is either positive or negative. There's no gray. So that's why things always get flipped like this. Okay, so what about the details? We know that Caligastian crew are have some sort of grand machination going with the Maudites. How exactly does it play out? You know, they don't give us all the details. They just are going to talk about the basics of this interaction between Eve and Sarah Patasia. Okay.
Section 3, The Temptation of Eve. Adam had just finished his first 100 years on earth when Sarepotasia, upon the death of his father, came to the leadership of the Western or Syrian Confederation of the Nautite Tribes. Sarepotasia was a brown-tinted man, a brilliant descendant of the one-time chief of the Dalmatia Commission on Health, mated with one of the master female minds of the blue race of those distant days. All down through the ages, this line had held authority and wielded a great influence among the Western Nautite tribes.
Okay, so there you're already seeing the little hints of the physicality. He was this magnificent brown-tinted specimen of humanity and manhood at that. Coming from this very high lineage, if you will. If I recall, that was, the Guardians of Health and Life, that group of 10, the corporeal staff, that was led by Lut. So Lut mated with the fanciest blue man female that he could find, and, you know, there was this wonderful lineage that stemmed down from him. All the way to Sarepotasia.
Mastermind, even.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty strong.
Yeah. Yeah. You can imagine that those initial members of the corporeal staff that joined the rebellion, they would have been very, very discriminating. You know, they wouldn't mate with anything, you know. They had plenty of time to wait and look around to find the cream of the Sangit crop, you know. So you had these, you know, the Nautites were very solid genetics. They would have been majestic individuals, you know, quite Adamic-like, you know, just, you know, don't forget that their DNA is, the DNA of that, of the original staff that joined the rebellion is very similar to Adamic DNA. You know, because it's been mutated over those 300,000 years, the first 300,000 years. So, I see in many ways, you know, Eve is engaging a like individual, right? I mean, see, again, like I said, so it's all the more it can go under the radar. She's unconsciously think, you know, well, this is effectively Adam. In many ways, he probably looked a lot, you know, in terms of physical form. Okay. And here you see it emphasized again. You know, they mentioned it with Eve back there. They said that Eve had most scrupulously carried out these instructions for more than 100 years. Here, Adam had just finished his first 100 years. It's that 100 years thing. They just keep stressing that. Because it's not just relevant to then. That's where we natch. That's the, you know, the, that's the duration, the maximum duration that we think in naturally. If humans are going to do anything beyond a scope of 100 years, you have to do it unnaturally. They're just reminding you that that's the time constant that's natural to us. It was to them too, because they were that attuned to us when they were downstepped. Okay, anything else there? The fact that this all kind of just conspires together, you know, that coincidentally, you know, his father, Sarepotasia's father died and he took over. It all just comes together here. And, but it leaves you cycling, well, is that all just coincidence, or do you suppose there's some manipulation by Caligastian crew? How did his father die? You know, you're left wondering. See, just what tiny little tweakings Caligastian crew were doing in this long game? Because even though Caligastia couldn't engage anything material, still can't. The rebel primary midwares. You know, and also if there's rebel, that, you know, the unrevealed order of angels, you know, those rebel lesser angels. I mean, they could have done, material things. So, we don't know. They don't explain how much of this might have appeared.
But it matters not because they were patient.
Yeah. Keep in mind that there's this behind the scenes, there's all kinds of things they don't explain, there's room for speculation about exactly how this all came to be as it did.
But do you think that even though this says 100 years, mm-hmm. even if it was 200 years, it was still nothing?
Oh, sure. Caligastia would have known, after 100 years, right, they're going to unwittingly have a time tension in their minds, just naturally. I can work with that. He knows, he holds all the cards here, like I said. See, so I'm sure it's not a coincidence that after 100 years, suddenly his scheme started to come into play. See?
That's where the clicks are on the dial.
Yeah.
You just, I'll
wait a few decades here, and after 100 years, they're going to naturally have an impatience that they didn't have before. I can play off of that.
This is sort of like so it makes you wonder whether or not, how many times Jesus had to say, "My hour is not yet come." He had to turn down this job, that job, mm-hmm. this thing. Mm-hmm. And he didn't turn them all down, but you wonder whether some of those were, here again, the wily coyote behind the scenes trying to make some things happen that weren't supposed to happen.
Yeah, up until Pentecost, many strange things. Right? You're open to assume, be careful about your speculations, obviously, but it's always a possibility, even easier there with secondary midwives, rebel secondary midwives during Jesus' time. They can do all kinds of mischievous things to try to thwart Jesus' mission. Have it so that coincidentally one of the apostles meets someone and they have a conversation that kind of puts an unfortunate thought, germ of a thought in one of the apostles' minds. And long after Jesus is gone, that thought, starts to kind of get them off base a little bit. They could have done all kinds of insidious things, that all would have gone right under the radar, of the humans involved. The fact that they say many strange things, it reminds you. We'll get to that paper here in a little bit. Keep going here.
Sarah Patatia had made several visits to the garden and had become deeply impressed with the righteousness of Adam's cause. And shortly after assuming the leadership of the Syrian Nadites, he announced his intention of establishing an affiliation with the work of Adam and Eve in the garden. The majority of his people joined him in this program, and Adam was cheered by the news that the most powerful and the most intelligent of all the neighboring tribes had swung over almost bodily to the support of the program for world improvement. It was decidedly heartening, and shortly after this great event, Sarah Patatia and his new staff were entertained by Adam and Eve in their own home.
Bum, bum, bum. You can just hear if we had a soundtrack here, all right, there would be an ominous tone right there.
Where was the new home, Mar-a-Lago?
Okay, so... why does it fly under everyone's radar, even flying under Adam's radar? Sarah Patatia, had made several visits, for a long time. It wasn't just, once he was the leader of the Nadites. And notice the word they slipped in there, how Sarah Patatia was impressed with the righteousness of Adam's cause. Right? So in other words, you start to have that righteousness word in your head. And so when things flip 180 degrees, you have self-righteousness. Okay? He's taking up the potential problem a notch. The higher positive potential you bring in play, know, the lower negative potential you bring in play. Right? Until righteousness is in play, self-righteousness, it can't be in play. Right? So that's why they slip that in. Remember, default is self-righteous impatience.
Right, so here, when Adam was cheered...
Yeah. None of that heartened, see? Yeah,
he might have think to himself, if he'd been really experienced and wise, mm-hmm. more so than he was, mm-hmm. he was, he might have said, I don't want to get ahead of myself on this.
Yeah. But see, I mean, we saw that. You know, they didn't last 24 hours. And they were already disheartened, remember?
Yeah, that's true.
Right? So he's a little too graspy, right? He's impatient. You know, he gets too excited too quickly, you know? I mean, you know, we all have that. We all have that tendency. You know, you get a little bit of a positive help with, you know, the venture you're working on. You know, and then immediately you start running with it, you know, and it's like, no.
It doesn't mean you don't. But
it doesn't mean you don't note the positive thing, but you gotta be careful.
Yeah,
you know, you gotta be careful to not overplay it. Play what you know what's dealt you. When you're dealt something positive, definitely leverage off of it, but don't overplay it. Right? And so, you know, we know he was a little grasping, so he would have overplayed this a little bit. The way he would have talked to Eve in the wake of this, you know, right? It would have fed into, remember they pointed out the things that Adam said, you know, fed into what Eve was thinking, right? So they're just reminding it isn't just, I mean, Eve is the one that does the biologic deed, yes, but right, the two of them mentally are setting themselves up together. Impatience. You know, they mentioned that back there. I don't know if I could find it again, but you know, if you go back and look, you know, they. Oh yeah, I think it was what I read at the beginning, wasn't it? Both of them were altogether too impatient, and yeah, they threw in the parenthetical, especially Eve, right? But both of them were altogether too impatient. Right, so, all right. Let's see, did we get everything there? Yeah, I mean, they're just stressing, you know, I mean, the numbers, you know, are feeding in almost over almost bodily to the sport. And I say all of it is just, Adam is getting too impressed by it, too excited. Okay?
Sarah Patatia became one of the most able and efficient of all of Adam's lieutenants. He was entirely honest and thoroughly sincere in all of his activities. He was never conscious, even later on, that he was being used as a circumstantial tool of the wily Caligastia.
Circumstantial tool.
Yeah. There's this whole clever indirect scheme going, see, right? You know, Caligastia is setting up the circumstances where, you know, everyone is like, well, you know, should I take the path to the left or the path to the right, you know? And it's like, oh, well, there's an interesting bird down that way. I'll take the path to the right. You know, just it all seems all innocent, but he's micromanaging all the subtle details. So all these subtle circumstances, all these indirect things going on that are influencing people in subtle ways. And again, you know, this is... one of Adam's lieutenants, see? I mean, so that just adds to it. I mean, it is like, Eve is again. It's like, well, it is like Adam here. It's one of Adam's most trusted lieutenants that I'm engaging here. It is like I'm engaging Adam. And she's not thinking that consciously, but right, subconsciously, that thought is there. See?
Grandfathered
in. And it just all feeds in, all these little details. That's why they give you all these little details. So that,
the word wily, they've used it a couple
times. Yeah, all right. You know, like I said, I mean, you know, the cleverness of a mind as brilliant as a Lenonidek, you know, is beyond our imagination. You know, we humans can dream up, you know, pretty impressive schemes, but nothing like the things, you know, he would do. You know, he would know that, you know, if I move this pebble, you know, that's going to have this effect, you know, 5 years from now. And I mean, it would just be very subtle things, you know, that would manipulate these people. Okay. So is one of the most able and efficient. So it's very natural. Yeah, and remember, you know, we've definitely determined this. Eve has lots and lots of downtime from babies, right? So there's a lot of stuff she's doing in an Adam, you know, if you will, in a material son mode of working on all of the details, right? She has hands free. You know, she's really working with Serapeitatia in that higher sense where they're both material sons, right? She has lots of directional tasks that she's involved in. Which is all the more reason why, right? She needs proper coordination, you know, with that. But again, Adam has his hands over, his hands are overly full, and he's delegating more to Eve than normally would be delegated to Eve, because there's such desperate circumstances. It all feeds together. Very, very, you know, it's just, you know, we could kind of go on forever thinking about all the things that add together to make this happen the way it did.
The impatience is behind the overly ambitious program. When you have an overly ambitious program, then you have too much to do.
Yeah.
You know, you're under even more undue pressure.
Yeah.
If he hadn't been so impatient, he wouldn't have had such an ambitious program. Everything would have stayed on an even keel.
Right. It's an insidious negative feedback loop that gets set up with this. You know, you're impatient, so you bite off more than you can chew. Which makes you more impatient, which makes you, it's a downward spiral. All right. Meanwhile, back to the story here. What happens next?
Presently, Serapeitatia became the associate chairman of the Edenic Commission on Tribal Relations, and many plans were laid for the more vigorous prosecution of the work of winning the remote tribes to the cause of the garden.
See, and again, it's like, coincidentally, he ends up being, you know, involved in exactly the thing that feeds into, you know, the scheme, right? So you can wonder, is how much of this is what would have happened properly without any scheming on the part of Caligastia, and what might he be feeding in, right? Is Caligastia, it's like, well, okay, I'm going to make it so eventually he's going to become the associate chairman of the Edenic Commission on Tribal Relations. And is that all part of his plan? You have to wonder. How much is Caligastia working with advantageous opportunities that come about, and how much did, you know, is he behind them coming into place in the first place? Many plans were laid for more vigorous prosecution, the impatience coming in again, biting off more than they can chew. Everyone is champing at the bit here.
Yeah, and they're going along and they're kind of consenting. So it's really reinforced, kind of a perfect storm of.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just, you know, Adam would be talking, you know, obviously Adam and Serapeitatia would be spending, have lots and lots of, you know, interactions, you know, planning this stuff, you know, and they would just feed off of each other's impatience, you know, and not even notice that they were doing it, and not staying. Keeping that, settling down to the long, long endurance test sort of mentality that they should have been in. Okay.
He held many conferences with Adam and Eve, especially with Eve, and they talked over many plans for improving their methods. One day, during a talk with Eve, it occurred to Serapeitia that it would be very helpful if, while awaiting the recruiting of large numbers of the Violet race, something could be done in the meantime immediately to advance the needy waiting tribes. Serapeitia contended that, if the Nodites, as part of the progressive and cooperative race, could have a leader born to them of part origin in the Violet stock, it would constitute a powerful tie binding these people more closely to the garden. And all of this was soberly and honestly considered to be for the good of the world, since this child, to be reared and educated in the garden, would exert a great influence for the good over his father's people.
You know, obviously it's feeding into that tradition of bringing tribes together, you know, through marriage. But you can't help but, you know, wonder, it occurred to Serapeitia. Well, exactly why? See, again, I mean, you got to wonder, was there some conversation he had at some point with some Nodite, you know, that's more directly being manipulated by Caligastian crew, you know, that kind of planted that seed? Again, you don't know for sure. They don't explain. But they keep speaking in this way, you know, where, and then they had this idea, and then they had this idea, you know, and how natural was that, or, you know, how much it might have been contrived as part of Caligastian's plot? We don't know. Let's see. What else do we have there? It's all pretty straightforward. But you notice they've got the most progressive and cooperative race. You've got that word progress, right? See, that's in there that we know is so difficult for us to not get carried away with, you know, and turn it into an ism.
It might not have taken much. This might have been just the organic path and all those confluence of things results.
Yeah, it just, you know, I mean, it appears that it could have been organic, but you can't help but keep coming back to, yeah, well, then what is this whole bit about them commenting that Caligastia is hatching this elaborate scheme? Right, there's got to be some part of it that's not organic.
Yeah.
See?
What was his input?
What was his influence exactly? They don't give you any direct statements about that. You're just left to speculate. Okay. Anyway, let's keep going.
It should again be emphasized that Serapeitia was altogether honest and wholly sincere in all that he proposed. He never once suspected that he was playing into the hands of Caligastia and Daligastia. Serapeitia was entirely loyal to the plan of building up a strong reserve of the Violet race before attempting the worldwide upstepping of the confused peoples of Urantia. But this would require hundreds of years to consummate, and he was impatient. He wanted to see some immediate results, something in his own lifetime. He made it clear to Eve that Adam was oftentimes discouraged by the little that had been accomplished towards uplifting the world.
See, there's Adam saying something like that, planting that seed, feeding his impatience. Everyone knows this is where we always get ourselves in trouble. I want to see something in my lifetime. That's so natural to think that. Right? If you're very, very earnest about something, I mean, you want to see it in your lifetime. And even when the revelators tell you, well, you know, you'll be able to, you know, check back on this planet and the universe broadcasts and see how things are going. I'd love to see it in my lifetime, you know, with my mortal eyes. You know, it's like, well, isn't that special? you know, we have to check, you know, catch ourselves getting impatient like that. You know, see, and just thinking that somehow your lifespan is relevant to, See, that's the seeds of self-righteousness. The very fact that you think that something profound should happening during the duration of your life. That's rudimentary self-righteousness.
And yet, a lot of things profound do happen.
Yeah, right.
You know, families, you do things. I mean,
But there's always something, you know. It's like, well, yeah, but there's been lots of families and lots of, you know. It's like, what about that thing that's more unique? You know, maybe I could play a role, you know, in something that, the moment that you have any awareness of ideals, that thought will creep into your head. It's just inescapable. You know, and just again, the way they worded it, that would require hundreds of years. You know, that would require many multiples of the length of time that's important here. 100 years. It's got to happen in 100 years. I can't even multiply that by a few. That's just too much, right?
It's only amplified by the fact that these are the guys, these are the movers and shakers in the equation. Right. If we don't do it, who's going to do it? You know,
right.
Just wow.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hopefully not overemphasizing, but I'm trying to kind of very methodically emphasize so that we can get out of the mode where we end up very unfortunately demonizing Eve. Okay, it's easy to put this new wine on an old wineskin and end up with a very unfortunate, final sense about the story. I'm trying to help with that. I mean, this is not just Eve. It's many, many things all working together. And they emphasized yet again. I mean, all of these movers and shakers, as you're saying there, Chris, right, are altogether honest and wholly sincere, right? You know, they emphasized before they said entirely honest and thoroughly sincere, right? How many adverbs can we use, right, to say the same thing?
Part of their blindness, though, they didn't suggest take this idea to Adam. It was like they knew Adam often got discouraged. So it's like, let's do something that he doesn't, and surprise him, you know, to help him. To help Adam.
Right, there's that. You know, it's like, you know, Adam has he has so many things on his plate. He's, you know, he gets discouraged by, you know, all of the, you know, that he has to deal with. You know, and, you know, he has delegated this to us. This is our task. You know, so, you know.
Right.
I mean, he doesn't want to be bothered by all the details. That's why he delegated it to us. It all feeds together into an unfortunate conclusion.
So what I'm getting at is, even though they're sincere, I think in the heart of hearts, they know that if they told Adam, he would throw cold water on it. I can't help but believe that. They didn't let Adam in on the secret.
They're right, but it's just as they're trying to stress, there isn't one shred of that's going on consciously.
No.
See? Mm-hmm. Right? That's why, you know, their honesty. Well, what level of honesty? Well, we can describe it as entirely. We can describe it as, you know, altogether. Right? I mean, they said, we should again emphasize, right, that, I mean, yes, there is some unfortunate unconscious rationalization schemes that we can speak about consciously, like you're just doing. It's like, well, okay, I think what's going on here, but they never have that conscious thought. You know, it's all under their radar. And that's an important lesson that, you know, I've emphasized this many times. Humans always think that their entire mind is what they're conscious of. No, a very small fraction of your mind or self is a conscious domain. Most of your mind or self is unconscious. It's like, well, then, you know, there's nothing going on there. No, there, not only are there decisions going on everywhere in that unconscious space, there's even choices going on in that unconscious space. The superconscious part of the unconscious parts of your mind or self is literally making choices. Right? There are unconscious choices. That's a sobering statement in the Revelation. And you're told that you literally have unconscious choices. Like, well, choices are relative to eternity. That could be problematic if that's not an appropriate choice. Yeah, it could. Well, I better take delight in cultivating, getting more of my mind in the conscious sphere. Yeah, you better. It's sad to record that so few persons do that. You know, that's what's going on between the lines of what they're talking about here. You need to be very aggressive in this. You don't want your mind functioning, let alone choosing unfortunate paths. You know, functioning along unfortunate paths or choosing unfortunate paths. There's no off switch on your personality. Your personality is identified with your mind or self. It innately has free will. It has an influence on your mind. Everything will be fine when you're very, very young. And all that's up there is what was put up there properly when you were encircled in the Holy Spirit. But over time, you begin to pollute that space. You begin to drag stuff in from the external world and shove it up into those, displace the proper seating up there. Like we've talked about many times, scientific dictation, social usage, and religious dogma will, you know, start to get up there instead of the threefold order of the cosmos. And that's when choices up there can start to take on very unfortunate results. Okay, so anyway, again, we don't want to be fraught with fear about this, but just remember, that's again why the fifth epical revelation is here. We're now naturally mucking around up there unconsciously because of the spiritual uplift in a way that humans never were for the previous million years. Right? That's why only now is there an emergency like this. Unconscious choice has never been a problem, a potential problem until now. It's all wonderful history that we're reading about here, but the truth flowing through it is very relevant to you here and now, why there's an emergency. One more thing,
Just what you just said. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at this and you look at the history of the revelations going awry mm-hmm. on this planet because mm-hmm. of the whole Lucifer idea of what do you want, fill in the blank, what
yeah.
are you doing
now? Yep.
And yet, you talk about this being an emergency in this world today.
Mm-hmm.
So the plan for this particular revelation that we have today may be, somewhat different than a plan would be for a prince's staff or an Adam and Eve in terms of you've said many times, the dispensational aspect of something mm-hmm. over a long period of time. Even mm-hmm. Michael mm-hmm. was in a way an emergency, because he's the only place he was only going to come to one planet, mm-hmm. and he did choose this one.
Right, he came to a rebel
they came
world.
Worst, because right. that's what he does, right. save them, right. that's what they right. do. And so, in those of us who, sit here and have been working for
decades to try and figure out, you know, why the Rancho book's not catching on. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got this great, amazing truth of what's going on here. And everybody says, okay, well, be patient, be patient, be patient. Mm-hmm. And then you sit here and say, well, we got an emergency, which sort of goes against being patient to some extent. Get to the emergency room.
Right, right.
You know, I'm just, it's not a simple answer, so to speak. And it's not, it's, I mean, I guess one does the best they can do with what they have. And, you know, where it goes, so to speak.
Yeah. And that which
we're not.
That which
we from another world being trained, okay, you're supposed to do it this way or that way.
Right.
We are, in a way, what evolution.
Right.
In a way, because we are that practicing part of it. And what happens with what we do.
And like I've stressed, the emergency is we have to somehow prevent an interregnum. No, that's not what the emergency is, right? No, there might still be an interregnum because that might be what's appropriate. You know, or a lot of times we think, well, emergency means someone's going to die. No, that's never an emergency. Everyone dies. Death is never an emergency in the eyes of celestial beings. Right? So, yeah, I mean, emergency, it's right, that like you're pointing out, there's a tension there. When you use that word, it's like, well, in what sense is there an emergency?
We can almost see it, you know. As you read the Ranch book and you live and you look around, I mean, you can tell from even inside your own mind that, you know, if a lot of these truths were evident in the lives of all the people, you know, a lot more people than they are, the world would definitely, you know, have a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
People, you know, and one would hope and imagine that we would be, you know, headed in a righter direction. Now, I'm not saying we're not headed in a righter direction.
In the higher sense, you can't be anything but headed in the right direction, right?
But you can see things that are sort of moving in that realm. But, you know, and I know you've experienced this, we've all experienced this, the frustration that we experience of saying, you know, gee, we're so fortunate, so lucky to have this come into our lives. We wish we could have it come into a lot more people's lives, you know. And we try to do it, you know, one on one and stuff like that. But
and again, that's why I stress: remember, an emergency revelation, especially, is meant to engage individuals, not groups. So the moment it engages one individual productively, it's succeeded. Right? It's not like a dispensational revelation where the point is to have this very universal, you know, manifestation. Right? So, but all that has to be played, you know, and if wisdom was straightforward, tribulation wouldn't be required to achieve it, right?
We'd all have it.
Right, yeah, and we'd all have it. So, but, you know, but they... they tell you at the same time they tell you that you need to find more wisdom than you have. They turn right around and say, but, you know, if you're sincere, that which you decide on earth is honored in heaven, whether it's right or wrong. Because again, no matter how big the self-righteousness, there's righteousness is always bigger. Righteousness is the size of the supreme being. And there is no finite being, you know, that can muster self-righteousness at any degree that is even remotely significant relative to that scale. It's in the 6 trillionth decimal place, you know, what any individual can do. So it's completely irrelevant in the big picture. The point is, if you're sincere, that's a favorable condition for growth. Even if, you know, what we're about to read about is very unfortunate, what happened. But in the big picture, they're sincere and they're honest. Those are two of the favorable conditions, right? Right? They're supplying favorable conditions. So everything will be grown because of what happened here. That's another way to think about why they're stressing that. Because no matter how much it appears that everything goes to hell in a handbasket, there was favorable conditions. So inescapably, there will be positive fruits of this action. Loyal, humble, sincere, just, patient. Right? And just means honest and law-abiding. So, all right. But, you know, just in terms of, you know, if you'd like something, if you'd like to somehow be used in a positive way during your lifetime, if you get off in these on these tangents, it's not going to happen. You're not going to be helpful to the situation, right? So for the short time span of your life, be patient. And if something can, positive can be manifested through you, you can be guaranteed it will be. Right? But you can be also guaranteed that nothing positive will come through you in the short term, in the span of your life, if you're impatient. Right? Okay. Okay, so we saw this whole bit. They wanted to see some immediate results. And let's see, did we get everything there? I think we did. Yeah, let's keep going here.
For more than 5 years, these plans were secretly matured. At last, they had developed to the point where Eve consented to have a secret conference with Kano, the most brilliant mind and active leader of the nearby colony of the friendly Nodites. Kano was very sympathetic with the Adamic regime. In fact, he was the sincere spiritual leader of those neighboring Nodites who favored friendly relations with the Garden.
So that village of Nodites is immediately, you know, on the mainland relative to the First Garden is where Kano is. Serapeutatia is, you know, he's the leader of the whole region of Nodites. Okay. All right, so here, you know, another is the other spot where in passing you go, huh, for more than 5 years these plans were secretly matured. Well, it's like, well, okay, yeah, so what? Well, you know, as you keep reading, you find out that the Melchizedeks arrive, you know, very shortly after, you know, everything falls apart. 5 years. Right. Right. So, you know, it didn't take long, and those on high, you know, that know what's going on in all of our minds, are reporting that not all is well in the mind of Eve. Yeah.
Back your bags.
Back your bags.
Yeah. Going on a trip.
All right.
Might as well head out now.
So, coincidentally, it's a 5-year trip, and they arrive, right? See, yeah, so that's the other time, see, in the book where you're going, I think maybe Jerusalem is about 15 light years away, because you got this 5-year thing in play again. Okay, so, you know, see, it's the two, you know, you have those two hints about that. The first is relative to the rebellion. The second is relative to the default. And how long it takes the Melchizedek receivers to get here. All right. But, you know, at last they had developed to the point where Eve consented to have a secret conference with Kano. So here is where you're going, now, wait a minute. Wouldn't that, you know, trigger some alarm bell, you know, in Eve's mind? It's like, wait a minute, now I'm having a secret conference with this other guy that, it's all... You know, they're lost in the fog of the whole rationalization scheme now. They've lost their sense of the big picture. You know, you're in the final moments of this, as it were.
But you can see it. We're going to do something. Adam's going to like it. We don't want to. It's surprising.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be so cool. I mean, he's the sincere spiritual leader. Right. Okay.
So how did Adam? I mean. You know how Adam and Eve can hear each other's thoughts?
Well, no, they can't hear each other's thoughts. They can communicate.
They have to make an effort to do it.
Yeah, I mean, you can't hear what I'm saying if I stop talking. right, yeah.
Nobody tried to say anything.
Right, I mean, you know, she's not reaching out to him.
Talking to them,
sort of. They're not reading each other's minds.
Right.
they're communicating, you know, they're sending messages through the mind energy system.
And she decided not to tell him.
Right.
She doesn't know.
Yeah. Right.
Still, surprising. You know, I mean, the pillow talk. Like, honey, how did your day go? Oh, I just had a secret meeting in the, you know.
Yeah, as if they're not dead exhausted, you know, when they get home and you know, don't immediately fall asleep. Right. See,
still, though, like, yeah, you know, yeah. Oh, what was that meeting about? I mean,
right, but see that, but you know, I mean,
secret,
your point is what I was just trying to stress is, obviously we've kind of crossed a line here now, right? I mean, they're still sincere, consciously, right? But unconsciously, there's some serious insincerity going on here. Like you're saying, it's like, you know, as soon as there's a secret meeting. You're going, well, wait a minute, you know, if she said, I'm gonna hide this from, she's not doing that consciously. More and more, their bodies are moving predicated on their unconscious mind and not their conscious mind. A conscious mind up here, it's all wonderful. And, you know, right? And, you know how that works. I mean, think about how you have a domain of your mind that's below kind of where all the conscious fancy stuff is, and it can kind of just do all the stuff. Matter of fact, in sports we call it the zone, mm-hmm. Right? And the whole point is to train that lower mind that's immediately in relation to the body, right, to be able to just do everything perfectly, precisely, right? And you keep conscious, you stay up there, you know, keeping that analytic stuff bounded away from all that so it doesn't muddle it up, right? You know, and you make the 50-foot curving putt down the slope, right, perfectly, and you have no memory of it afterwards.
Because you didn't think of that.
Right, because, yeah, it was all your unconscious mind doing it. You know, but for observers looking, it's like, well, no, but look at it. It's all so complicated and everything so precise. You know, they have to be engaging that consciously. No, you don't. No, not at all. Right? So, see, that's what's happening more and more. They're becoming automatons, you know, as it were, see, in terms of what's actually going on physically, because they're up in the clouds consciously, with all the fancy ideals of what they're doing and whatnot, and it just they're not providing proper oversight of their specific material doings.
Yeah, the trick
it's all just on automatic pilot, see?
Was for them to think, okay, we're just doing what we're supposed to do.
Yeah.
This is all part of what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. I mean, another example where you know you work like that. I mean, you spend a whole bunch of time up front getting it all sorted out in your head, and then you jump into it, and things don't go well, and then you recognize, no wonder it didn't. I wasn't providing proper oversight. I sort of just, you know, unleashed myself because I thought, you know, I could just be this. I pre-programmed myself so perfectly I could just let the automaton take care of everything, and then you trip and fall on your face, and then it occurs to you, oh, there needed to be some oversight there. Yeah, right. That's what's going on in a very, you know, significant way here.
Or you're driving to work.
Yeah.
And you're thinking about a dozen things, and your automatic pilot has taken over, and it's not the automatic pilot that you turn on in your car.
Yeah, right. And you get there, and it's like, man, I have no memory of actually paying attention to oncoming traffic and stuff. Was I doing something dangerous? No. I've programmed myself so well. I was taking care of all that unconsciously.
Yeah, I can text when I drive.
I mean, there's, you know, or you'll stop the car because you think you've gotten your destination. You go, wait a minute, what am I doing here? I wanted to go over there. You know, and you unconsciously went where you go every day, you know, like you wanted to go to the restaurant. Instead, you ended up at work.
Yeah.
And you're going, well, what on earth, how could I have safely gotten to work? I have I wasn't over-controlling this process. No, I mean, your unconscious mind was doing everything wonderfully. You stopped for every stoplight and used your blinker and everything. You know, see, that's what's going on here. So much of what's happening is just kind of on autopilot here.
My only reservation, it's not like she's programmed to be deceitful. It's not like she has a history of... It seemed like for all these secret meetings, I just don't see how she would not at some point have had to lie to Adam. You know, like, nothing. Like, what do you mean nothing? Nothing happened. No, there was nothing at the meeting. Like,
yeah, but see, but again, you know that because they keep stressing that never happened. Right? So... You have to look for another way of understanding it. It's like, well, it seems like she had to have lied. It's like, well, then, no, you know she didn't. There was no deceit. I mean, if there had been deceit, it would have been rebellion. Okay? You know, if anything, you know, those on high are finally going to tell you that didn't happen here. You know, and declare it to just be a default and not a rebellion. So you have to look for another way to understand it. And one of the things I'm quite sure was happening is you think you've been busy in your life, right? I mean, we need to assume that they're busy beyond belief. A lot of times a husband and wife will joke, well, you know, I saw my spouse, you know, for 5 minutes a week ago. I mean, you get into this mode where, you know, you hardly ever even see each other. Because, you know, because you've got so many kids and they've got so many after-school activities and, you know, and yada, 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 and you both are working jobs. And, I mean, they're, you know, look how many kids they've got. They're just, I bet they don't see a lot of each other.
Plus the other side of the equation, which is the Kano and the Cerevitatia. First of all, you know, they don't read. They're not, you know, you think they're kind of cool, but they're probably way, way below intelligence that we know of. And they're kind of like, you know, oh, come on, you know, this has been really, really important for us to do. You know, this is a big deal. That kind of thing. That they're very convinced that this is going to be something that could be done. And so there's, you know, there's that aspect of their side of the story that's influencing her as well.
Right, and they stress that, you know, you know, the Nodites don't have and really can't hold in their mind the big picture that needs to be held in the mind. You know, and she's getting sucked into that space. She's getting dumbed down, as it were, you know, by their ignorance. You know, she's being limited by the ignorance of others. You know, I use that expression all the time. You know, that happens naturally. You don't recognize that you've gotten sucked into a rationalization, you know, that an ignorant person can spin very, you know, deftly, right? You just get sucked into it. So, yeah, I mean, they definitely stress that. We know that that's going on because they make that point, that she's unwittingly gotten sucked into their lesser sense of things, right? And it all starts to make sense to her, right? You know, whereas if she just lifted her head up, like, oh, wait a minute, no, right? It's exactly like what happened to Lucifer, right? He got himself sucked down into this little space, and everything seemed, he dotted every I, crossed everything, it all seemed to be just spot on brilliant. You know, and then something caused him to lift his head up, and he went, oh, wait a minute, what am I thinking? No, this is clueless. You know, and that's the point. It shifted to deceit, right? Because he didn't have the courage to admit what a numbskull he was. You know, how he'd gotten himself so circumscribed. See, we've got the exact same process happening with Eve, you know, and Adam to a degree too. They get down in this circumscribed space, but you know, this deed, you know, gets done physically. You know, and afterwards, you pulled your head up. Well, okay, she may have had the courage to say, oops, but, you know, you can't undo the physical deed.
Mm-hmm. Part of this is just the nature of mind. Because, well, I know I'm playing chess. I used to spend too much time doing that. But you play to the competition. If someone's really sharp, you know, you tend to up your game. Mm-hmm. If someone's not, you get careless.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like when you're engaging someone, if you engage a brilliant person, you know, it just automatically kind of draws you up there in that space you normally may not
dwell
in.
Yeah.
But if you're speaking to someone who's, hey, Joe, how's the Broncos doing? You know, I mean, you go into that space.
Yeah.
But the computer cheats in chess.
Yeah, and so, I mean, so John's point, you know, is very probably, even though it says Kano, the most brilliant mind and active leader, I mean, the word brilliant is relative.
Right.
Like we pointed out, you know, it's completely ignorant, this so-called brilliance, relative to the brilliance of Caligastia, say, right? There's brilliant and there's brilliant. So, yeah. Eve is getting sucked down into this small space where everything seems to be just all proper. She needs to, you know, she's forgetting to keep her head up, you know, to keep the big picture in mind. Okay, let's see. But again, just like Serpentatia, you notice they're stressing, you know, again, how it's just keeping her sucked down into this small space, that Kano is very sympathetic with the Adamic regime, right? You know, see, notice how feelings are starting to play a very important role here, right? The more you get pulled down, the more you're driven by feelings, okay? So they're starting to point that out, and they're kind of bringing that, they're going to bring that to a head here in a second. It starts to become all too familiar, you know, the pathology of what's happening here, where we get caught up in the feelings of, oh, this is so fantastic. I mean, he's not just sympathetic, he's very sympathetic. It's so exciting, it's so wonderful, right? It's too wonderful to pause and check the details. Yeah, and then he's a sincere spiritual leader. It's all just, right? You can see the spiritual candy, right? And you're not using your insight to penetrate through and see that it's hollow, it's just a wonderful white coating on a hollow sphere. It's a sophistry, and as they pointed out, when all is said and done, it's a sophistry because Caligastia saw to it. He saw to it that, and when all was said and done, you had spiritual candy wrapped around falsehood, you know, and so you just judge it by its appearance, by its surface, and you pop it in your mouth, you know, to delight in the wonderful, you know, taste of that spiritual candy, you know, and then it's too late. You just swallowed the the poison inside the pill. Okay. All right.
The fateful meeting occurred during the twilight hours of the autumn evening, not far from the home of Adam. Eve had never before met the beautiful and enthusiastic Kano, and he was a magnificent specimen of the survival of the superior physique and outstanding intellect of his remote progenitors of the prince's staff. And Kano also thoroughly believed in the righteousness of the Serpentatia project. Outside of the garden, multiple mating was a common practice.
Right, so they throw in that little parenthetical to remind you how the mores are involved in, like what John was saying, the way the Nodites are, you know, rationalized everything. You know. But see, the rest of that paragraph, right, where are we now? Okay, now it's down to just hormones. And okay. I mean, it's a cool twilight. You know, his pecs are glistening in the moonlight, right? He's this magnificent specimen of the survival of the superior physique. Right? See, when it gets down to the final thing, it's down to that, right? You know, and, you know, that's what, you know, it's that basic hormonal chemistry that's the closer of this. And, you know, I'm not making things up. You know, they'll tell you, you know, we won't get to it tonight because we've spread this out so much. But, you know, later on they explain, yes, there's moonlight, right? And, you know, his bronze pecs, see, are glistening. Remember, they meant it the brown tinted. All this, right? Okay. I mean, it's just all there, you know. And you've got that basic, you know, it's an outstanding intellect and all that, right? So it's just, you know, she's just coming down, checking the boxes until the final box, the biologic foundation is being checked. And the automaton does the rest. Mm-hmm. We all know there's not a lot of high mind going on when you're in the final throes of this phenomenon. Okay. Anything else I want to stress there? You could see how I was, you know, blurring the lines between what they say about Serapeutica and what they say here about Cana, but, you know, they're allowing you to do that, you know, that he is like Serapeutica, you know, that he's this wonderful expression of those remote progenitors, just like Serapeutica is. So you can, you know, can blend the two, right? Yeah, yeah. Right. Just, you know, everything is giving this overwhelming feeling, you know, in Eve's mind. Right. See, that's, you know, once the feelings are strong enough, you know, and opaque enough, right, all objectivity is masked by them. Right. Now, you know, when you get feelings fully manifested like that, she couldn't be objective if she tried. Right. There is an opaque cloud of feelings between her and what she needs to be seeing at that point. I had to pull back on the reins. So that's the way it'll work for any of us, too. That,
if there had been any deceit, she probably would have picked up on the
media. Yeah. Yeah. See, that would have punched through. Right. Right. But see, it's just all that, you know, like I said, all those higher boxes, she's checked them off. And so, you know, she can let go of all those higher details, you know, and just let the subjectivity of feelings be the ruling thing, a conscious fact. We all know that's what, you know, it takes any of us off, you know, off the rails. And that's why it's so stark when they tell you it's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. Right? You know, that long-standing belief that very, very intense feelings prove that you're very close to God. Right? There isn't a human that's ever lived that hasn't assumed that. I mean, that is the assumption of all of human history, that the more intense the feeling, right? You know, it obviously has to go from feeling, mere feeling, to emotion, right? It has to have a physiological, you know, consequence. It's so, the feeling is so intense. You know, that, you know, if that isn't happening, you know you are not close to God. I mean, you know, we've always believed that that's proof of your closeness to God. And the revelation says the exact opposite. No. The more overwhelmed by feelings are, the farther you are from God. It's like, well, but, I mean, if I got close to God, wouldn't that produce a feeling? Yes, it does. Okay, but you won't be overwhelmed by feelings there. You'll have this strange control of those feelings that you didn't think was possible. You'll have a peace that passes all understanding. See, the feelings will be, technically, they'll be more intense when you generate them from the top down, then anything you can generate from the bottom up. But there'll be this very curious fact that, and yet I'm in control, not the feelings. I didn't think that was possible to feel that intensely without losing control.
You want to understand it.
Right. And if, you know, see, and right, it, you know, the only thing you can conclude from the outside observing that is, well, he must be beside himself. We know how that works. You see? It's that fact that when when the feelings are controlling you, that's a sure sign that you've gotten to those feelings bottom up, and there's no closeness to God there. You can use that as a simple litmus test to reject that as something that you should try to obey, right? Because you might start thinking, I think I just got a message from God, and I should dedicate the rest of my life to that. You know, that's, you know, like the Revelators say, no, you should definitely dismiss that kind of stuff. Okay, let's get the final paragraph in here.
Influenced by flattery, enthusiasm, and great personal persuasion, Eve then and there consented to embark upon the much-discussed enterprise, to add her own little scheme of world-saving to the larger and more far-reaching divine plan. Before she quite realized what was transpiring, the fatal step had been taken. It was done.
See, she did, there was a, well, right, she did get an objective flash, see, but it was, like I said, too late. And again, look at how that starts out. I mean, saying that she's been pulled down by material gravity to you, down to the very unfortunate animal level thing. Flattery, for Pete's sake, yeah, is a key thing here now. Right. You're literally getting down there where, you know, to that level of mind where we tell stories where, and then she stood in front of the mirror and said, mirror, mirror on the wall. I mean, we're down there, okay? Like I said, she's just, before she quite realized what was transpiring, you know, she didn't recognize how she had just been totally drugged down, and there was nothing but the level of the flesh and intense feelings is all that was going on consciously in her mind. And she's just, you know, she's hopelessly subjective. She's subject to flattery now, even.
Definitely a seduction.
Yeah.
It's just a little scheme of world saving.
Yes. Her own little scheme. Yeah. See, I'm glad you brought that out. See, why did they, again, how it could have, so obviously way up front when they were still thinking about this more, before there were this last moment where she's overwhelmed by feelings, they had rationalized that, it's such a small little thing, okay, in this big, big effort. I mean, the important issue is to be judged in terms of quantity. No. Quality. See, she forgot that. Yeah. So that one, too, is important because we always get into that mode. A lot of times it's in the reverse. It's like, well, this is obviously significant. Look at the numbers. Right? I mean, this march is globally consequential. I mean, look at how many people are marching. As if it had anything really to do with quantity. And it's like, step back a second and look at the quality of it. There is no quality. All right. Technically, the fact that the numbers are big, that's a negative, not a positive. All right. The bigger the numbers with poor quality, the worse the problem, right? But the wonderful thing about, quality, unlike quantity, which is arithmetic, quality is geometric. qualities like the mustard seed. One individual with quality can have much more impact on the world than tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of individuals with no quality, no cosmic quality. You know, and an emergency revelation knows that. That's the point. It's looking for a few individuals, right, to have quality of thinking. Right? We don't have to bring everyone into, you know, the quest for knowledge and wisdom, but a little quality goes a long way because it's geometric in its influence. So that's the mathematics that an emergency revelation is predicated on. Quality over quantity. All right, anything else there? Let's see, we should probably wrap it up. Well, you got something?
Yeah. I do.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
So you think about it, okay, so it took 5 years getting this plan together. Mm-hmm. So she went into this meeting. She must have been ovulating when she went in there, knowing that if she had sex, it wasn't going to just be to have sex and not get pregnant.
Yeah, remember, we actually figured that out. You know, they gave us, so we know she was ready to have a next kid.
Whatever.
So,
I mean, it was, you know, before she realized what was happening, it was done. I mean, yes and no. I mean,
yeah. By that they just mean it's not before she realized that, you know, she was about to have sex with Kano. No, not that. No. You know, before she recognized the objective consequences of this. Right, it was done. Right, she was, you know, that's the whole point. I mean, they were fully aware of all this, you know, the lesser things and, you know, the subjective things.
So it was, yeah, in a way,
yeah,
premeditated.
Right, all the details were, you know, like you said, it was over 5 years. I mean, they'd worked out all the details. They had the whole scheme, you know, exactly. You know, I mean, not just getting up to this point, but, you know, exactly how the child would be raised and where the child would go to uplift the people and blah, you know, I'm sure they had a vast plan that they had worked out for this child. Right. But all of it was down there, devoid of that big picture sense that there's a quality issue here. I mean, rebellions and defaults are about that disrupting the relationship to unity. It's a quality issue, not a quantity issue. That's the fundamental thing. They were so into the material quantity details, they lost sight of whether or not all of these material minutiae had some relationship to unity. No, it was evil. It was disrupted. It was severed from relationship to unity. But it doesn't appear that way to the individuals because they've got this little sphere.
2020.
Right. Well, they've got this little sphere of self-made unity.
Yep.
Self-righteousness. See. Right. Your free will allows you to make a substitute unity, as it were. Right? There is the unity that you're trying to humbly synchronize with. Right? But you can create this little domain severed from that that gives the appearance of unity to you in your circumscribed space. It seems like it actually goes to infinity. You know, if you just lift up, you can see, no, it's only this big. That's what happens. You just get down in there, you lose all objectivity, but it appears. Oh, we've got it all. We're in perfect synchrony with the continuumness, with the unity. Everything is as it should be. But no, it's a unity of your own construct. It's a self-righteousness. It's not the unity of the righteousness.
Doesn't extend from the original purpose anymore.
See, that's the difficulty of giving an individual personality. They can take a hold of spirit, you know, and make a false unity. So it all appears to be wonderful to you, but it isn't really. See, and that's the thing. Okay. But to just, you know, and you know, you mentioned about the fight. You see, much discussed enterprise, just like they stress there. Yep. You have something too?
So I didn't say it because I didn't know how to word, word it, and I don't know if it's going to come out right. So back to a few people that have quality of mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if the few people on the planet that have quality of mind, if there is something going on that is not visible that can help the situation having that quality of mind.
Well, again, remember that that's the emergency. It's sad to record that so few persons on your rancho have quality of mind. See, and you, and there's never been more than 1% in leaders. You don't need a high percentage, but you have to have some with some genuine quality of mind.
What I'm trying to get at is, say you have this individual that has quality of mind.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something that could happen that is not visible to us?
Well, could help
yeah,
it.
Yes, I understand. Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, in the Revelation they talk about all kinds of, you know, like Master Seraphim, for instance. There's all kinds of individuals on the planet, celestial individuals, that are working to foster those people that have some quality of mind for them to have a positive impact on the world. Yeah, I mean, they're, you know, and if nothing else, they're training reservists with quality of mind so that, you know, if they need to, they can activate one of those little nuggets of quality of mind, you know, and see to its effective influence, that individual's effective influence on the group. Yeah, yeah, there's lots and lots of that. But You can reach a threshold limit where there's too many people that are unwittingly overruling this with their free will, short-circuiting, so that no matter how many people you have, celestials you have working to have this have some positive benefit to the world, the individuals are short-circuiting their efforts. You know, the angels work and work and work to bring things together, and then you go off at a right angle. And they go, okay, I got to start all over again.
Because of free will.
Because of free will, yeah. Okay, we need to wrap it up, but just one, you know, there's one other point here I wanted to mention again, why this is so familiar. Her own little scheme of what? World saving. World saving, you know, for Pete's sake. You know, all those people on the planet think that, you know, they're here to save the world. It's like, well, okay, yeah, Adam and Eve were kind of there to save the world. There's some truth to that for them. But, again, they're biting off more than they can chew, like we talked about earlier. They're getting it, you know. You, over time, you will save the world, not tomorrow, not tonight, you know, in the moonlight. Okay, you're not, you know, that, and see, that's, you know, and you know that's what people get. It's like, oh, this is the key. When I do this, I'm going to save the world. You know, as if you could somehow fit that into a moment. Okay. Yep, so it's all there. Everything that you hear, everyone around you that gets spiritually animated, saying and doing. The revelators are saying, let this be an object lesson to you. The moral of the story is, right, you know, and you should not want to be adding insult to injury here, you know, and doing effectively exactly what Eve did because of your impatience and your desire to save the world. Okay. We'll get into when she did open her eyes before she quite realized, she did realize. See the net title, the next thing, the realization of default. Okay. But we'll get into what the consequences are here next time. Let's take a moment, everyone.